And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is Thursday, April the 27th, 2017. 1:12 coming up on 1:13 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I am Scott Spears along with you for the ride today on the Now program. And today we're going to talk with a man who is synonymous in the world of show business. He knows the ins and outs better than anybody else. A true television legend, pioneer, and really an American treasure. The original host of Let's Make a Deal, Monty Hall. Monty, how are you?
Oh, not too great. Not too great. But age is sick as troll.
Well, Monty, I wanted to ask you this. You're now into your ninth decade. What's the secret to living so long?
There's no secret, boy. Just keep the Grim Reaper away.
Do you exercise regularly, keep active?
No longer. I broke my hip about 10 years ago, and that took me off the tennis courts. And I haven't been doing any exercise since.
What is life like these days? Do you still enjoy it?
No, it's kind of rough. I'll tell you, you know the old expression, old age is not for sissies. But it's a tough go. My wife hasn't been well, and I've been fighting off a few things myself. So it's tough. I'm going to be 96. That's an old age.
Did you ever think you'd live to be that old? I've heard people say, I never thought I'd make 96.
No way.
Well, I'm glad you have, and I'm glad you're here today. Monty, I want to discuss a few things about your career. And how did you break into broadcasting? I don't think I've ever heard that.
Well, when I was a young kid, my mother was an actress in Winnipeg, Canada, in a local theater. And they got me involved in doing little children's parts. And then I went to high school. I took some of the parts in high school. And then I took the lead at college. And I was recruited out of college into radio broadcasting and on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And from that point on, I took a job full-time on graduation. And off I went to Toronto to further my career, and television started, and away we went.
What to you makes a good television broadcaster or a good broadcaster in general?
A person? You mean a person, let's say somebody's doing my show? What show would you say?
Let's say a game show. Your game show's still on the air. Let's Make a Deal. What makes a good host for that show?
Well, first of all, you have to have command of the stage. You have to have command of the audience. You can't let them run roughshod over you. You have to be in charge, correct? You're in charge. And once you're in charge, use your charm to make sure that everybody gets along very well, and that even when they lose, they still love you.
Your game show is really one of two game shows that is still on and very popular, Let's Make a Deal and Price is Right, every day on the network. Does that make you happy that it's still there, still going strong?
Oh, of course it does, in many ways. Don't forget that besides the thrill of having a show on the air for 60 years, there's the ability to use that fame to further your desires, things that you want to do in the world of charity and so on. This allowed me to do all my charity work because I had a calling card. And it was a calling card that gave me entree to everything, and people wanted to see, wanted me to come and perform, and I used that as my calling card to raise an enormous amount of money, which is, I think, the biggest signature I have.
A lot of game shows don't make it, certainly don't make it 60 years. Why has Let's Make a Deal, in your opinion, made it?
Well, people identify. See, there's no given. You watch Wayne Brady do the show today, very much like I did it. And it's a matter of people making choices for something, you're risking what they've got for something unknown. People at home play along by saying, this is what I would do if I were there. I would take the door. I would take the curtain, and so on and so on. People identify. And any good show, people have to identify. Now, you take a show like Jeopardy, which is a completely different kind of a show. On that show, the audience at home are not as brilliant as some of the people on the show, so they get their kicks by cheering for and hoping that that person will score a big triumph.
Wayne Brady currently is in the position that you were in. Do you like Wayne as the host of that show?
Yes, I do.
Was it hard to turn it over to somebody else?
No, not at all. Not at all. Don't forget, I did it for, what, 30 years? It was time to hang up my cue. And I picked Wayne, and he was the right choice.
How did Let's Make a Deal happen? How did that all come about?
Well, I remember way back in those days, I was doing a show called Video Village. And at that time, I sold my first show to NBC called Your First Impression. I needed someone to look after the show for me while I was doing Video Village. I hired Steve Hatos. He became my partner. And we talked about various ideas, and we would meet for lunch and thrash out ideas and thrash it out. As any good packager would do, you could plow through 100 ideas until you find what you think works.
When you went to sell that to the network, was that an easy sell, that show?
Oh, no. First of all, there were only three networks in those days. No syndication. No, nothing. Just three networks. And you had three possible customers. CBS informed us right away they're not buying a game show. They're limited, put it down to two shows, two networks. So we only had two possible. That's a very limited audience. Today, of course, you have hundreds of channels. But we only had two. And it was very tough because the buyer had never seen a show where you didn't pre-select contestants, where they didn't have to answer questions, where it was just taken at random, and it was kind of phonics of it. I remember the first time we showed it to you, we did a run-through at NBC, and so we took a studio audience, a large studio audience, and we didn't have any prizes, but we had little slips of paper that said refrigerator or rubber chicken, you know. And when the run-through was over, the audience applauded for 15 straight minutes. I went backstage into the green room where Steve Hatos, my partner, was with the network officials. I walked in triumphantly to find long faces. I was wrong. And Steve said, "He doesn't like the show." I said, "Are you kidding me? Listen, they're still screaming out there. I'd never seen anything like it. The audience is still applauding." "Oh, yeah," the network guy said. "Good for the first day. What do you do the second day?" Can you believe that?
That's amazing.
"What do you do the second day?" This man didn't last in his job very long.
And here we are 60 years later.
That's 60 years later.
Yeah. Right. Is there something about that show that you remember? When I say Let's Make a Deal, what's the first thing that pops in your mind?
People, their reactions.
Put it
in a situation where they have to make a choice. Nervous people, excited people, and our job was to orchestrate them, make sure that they didn't go crazy, and play the game.
Do you have a favorite moment from that show?
Oh, there are a lot of moments. The favorite moments were when something went wrong. I loved it when something went wrong, because then we could have all kinds of fun ad-libbing our way out of it. And that was the best part of it for me. And things went wrong quite often. Things falling down, animals running loose, all kinds of stuff. No way. For me, it was fun. I enjoyed the people.
When you look back at it, is there a bad memory that sticks out? Is there a day when, boy, even though things went wrong, it just, boy, this is not fun?
Well, I think the interesting thing was I was talking to the contestant, asking whether she wanted to go for what was behind the door number two, or stay with a television set. As I was talking to her, the stagehand somehow got mixed up and opened door number two before she could make up her decision. And there was her car. And she looked dumbfounded. Well, there was the car. And I'm asking her whether she wants the car. And I said to her, whoa, we made a big mistake here, but it's our mistake. The car is yours if you want it. She said, I want it. I remember that. Once you make a mistake, there's no covering it up. You got to go with it.
That's right. When you look back at your entire career, what do you consider to be the high? You've done so many things.
That's hard to say. Of course, Les McNeil stands out because it's the most successful show, one of the most successful shows of all time. So you'd have to put that down as number one in the category. And other than that, I think I enjoyed sportscasting. When I was doing my sportscasting, that gave me a great pleasure. I did boxing and wrestling. I did international soccer for the Polo Grounds of New York. I did hockey for the New York Rangers. So I love sports. So I'd say that after Let's Make a Deal, it was sportscasting. After that, it had to be all those musical shows that I did, singing and acting. Because I did a lot. You know, I did a lot of acting and a lot of singing. And I enjoyed that, too.
Now that you look back at the last 96 years, do you have any regrets?
Well, at one time, I regretted not going into medical school. I thought that's where I was going to go. But I didn't end up that way. And for a short time, I had regrets. But as I went through life doing and accomplishing what I did, bringing happiness to millions of people, raising hundreds of millions of dollars for charity, I have no regrets. Edith Piaf sings, I have no regrets. That's my song, too.
There is this out there, I'm sure you're aware, the Monty Hall problem. What is that to your best knowledge?
I wish we would bring that up because I haven't been able to explain it to anybody.
No, I don't understand it either. I was trying to read it earlier, and it has something to do with doors. But where did that come from?
I was just a kid. One of the books, there's a lot of books written about it. Sit down and study the book very carefully because it would take me an hour and a half to get
explaining it. When something comes up, I mean, that's something you can't expect that would become popular, actually. What did you think of that? I mean, it's kind of an odd thing.
Well, you know, I said to my family, I said, here I have made a great success of my show. It's one of the all-time successful shows, one of the longest in history. I said, I've raised $1 billion for charity over 60, 70 years. And people are going to ask me what I think about the Monty Hall problem. I said, wrong. I don't want to talk about the Monty Hall problem. I'm Three Doors. I'd rather talk about the things that I did.
Absolutely. At this age, 96, are there still things going in your head that you still want to do in the entertainment industry or in your personal life?
You know, at this time, Scott, I just want to keep the wolf away from the door. You know, when you get to be 95, 96, illness plays a big part of your life. And I've been staving off things straight and left. And I've been very fortunate. My wife has not been that fortunate, and she has not been well lately. So that's a hardship for us to withstand as we get older.
Do you still like going to the office? Is it still fun to get out?
I do not go to the office any longer.
You stopped doing that?
I stopped doing that. I just concentrate on the family, concentrate on through my couple of benefits here and there, raising some money here and there, and playing with the grandchildren.
You know, Monty, it's interesting because when you say the name Monty Hall, everybody knows the name. You are the person. It's a strange question to ask, I guess, but are you aware that you are a part of people's lives, that you are Monty Hall?
Oh, yeah, you get to realize it. Listen, I started realizing it 34 years ago when the New York Times put me in their crossword puzzles.
Yeah, I bet that is a kick. What's the greatest accolade you have ever gotten?
I don't know about the reason, but one of the greatest of the awards that I've received, and I have five honorary doctorates, which are very important to me, five honorary doctorates. But I've also got the Order of Canada, the highest award Canada gives out. I think that's the number one, the Order of Canada. That's a very high thing. I also got from the Variety Club internationally, the International Humanitarian Award back in 1958 and so on. I've received so many awards, it's hard to say, but each one of them has its own significance.
Monty, you and I did an interview a few years ago. I'm trying to remember how long ago it was, but in that interview, you brought up a story that I had never heard, and I'm trying to get it right here, and I want you to tell it if you could. Early in your career, somebody gave you, I think it was some money, to get started. What was it? Gave you your break, but they didn't want you to...
It was the most wonderful story. I had dropped out of college because we ran out of money. I went to work at a clothing wholesale. I was washing the floors at this clothing wholesale when a gentleman from a building from across the way came to visit my boss, and he noticed me washing the floor. And he said to my boss, "Who is that young man?" And he said, "Well, that's Monty Hall. What's he doing washing floors?" "Well, why is he washing floors? He should be at school." And he said, "Well, he works for me. I try to get a good wage, but he dropped out of school." He says to my father. He saw my father with her. He said, "Have him give me a call tomorrow." I gave him a call. He said, "Come up and see me at my wholesale." Now, this man was 29 years old. 29, that's all he was. His father left with a big business. He was single, mad about town, most unlikely person in the world to ever pick a guy like me out of washing floors. When I came, he said, "How would you like to go back to school?" I said, "Oh, I'd love it." He says, "I will make it possible, but you have to play by my rules. I want you to be a student. No getting around. I want you to show me your report card every month. I want you to make out a budget. I want you never to tell anybody where you got the money. That'll be just between you and me. And you're going to do it for somebody else someday. That's your pledge." All these things. I said, "I will live by those pledges." He put me through the next 3 years of college. I graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree. I then decided to go into broadcasting. I went to Toronto, and the first year in Toronto, I sent him $300. $300 on the loan he gave me. The second year I sent $300, and the third year I sold $300 more. I paid it off the bill. $900 was his total investment in me. $900 was his total investment. And what that investment brought back, the hundreds of thousands of dollars that I raised for charity, the children that I put through college, the things that I could do because of one man's faith in me, a stranger.
Why do you think he did it?
I asked him that one year when I went to visit him up in Canada. He said, "Maybe I saw something of you in me. I never finished my college career, and I figured maybe I could help somebody else do what I dropped out." But he said, "I took an investment in you, and it's the greatest thing that ever happened in my life. Do you know that years later, I went up to Winnipeg, Canada, where he was ill. He was 99 years old. He was blind and practically deaf. And I went to visit him in the home there. And I sat with him, and we were cupped by ear. He cupped his ears close to me so he could possibly hear what I'm saying. And at one point in the conversation, I said, "Max, you gave me a life." And he would come to me and said, "No, Monty, you gave me a life." And that was the greatest thing that I can remember.
The emotional
moment with this man looking at me, who each derived from this relationship a life.
You know, Monty, I just have two questions left here. When you look back at that situation, it's hard to say, but do you think you would have happened if that had not happened?
No. How many times like that can happen in one's lifetime?
Yeah, it's
the fact that I was in at this wholesale, the fact that I was washing the scrubbing the floor, the fact that a man looked and saw a young man scrubbing the floor, and the fact that he didn't like the idea that the young man was doing that, that all had to come together in one scene. And the fact that he was wanted to do something for me, unheard of, but he did it. And it was the greatest thing that happened in his life, the greatest thing that happened in my life.
When you look back at your life now, 96 years, when people are looking at your life and looking at the tapes 96 years from now, how do you hope they look back on Monty Hall?
Oh, no idea. See, things change so rapidly in our universe, I can't ask that question.
Well, let me ask you this question, Monty. You were so versed in television for so many years. Now it all seems to be reality television and politics. That's what people watch. What do you think of the current political state?
Well, I don't like to make any statement on the air or broadcast over the air. I keep my own opinions, but I would not say it's the best of times.
Well,
just leave it at that.
I understand that. And Monty, I hope you keep on keeping on, and I hope you can come back in the future sometime, because it is always a pleasure.
So too. That'll mean that I'm still here.
That's right. I want you to still be here. You'll have to come back on the 96th. That'll be good.
Call me.
Absolutely. Stay well, Monty, and I hope your wife feels good. Thank you, Monty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The legendary Monty Hall. You can't beat that. Now, we are going to go transition here quickly because we only have 26 minutes left in the program. We do have Carlos Bringer, who we had on in hour number one. Now, he did the debate with Lee Harvey Oswald. We're going to get him back on the line here momentarily, but here is a moment from that debate. August 21st, 1963, the moment he was talking about earlier on. Lee Harvey Oswald on radio with Carlos Bringer.
Knowing, as you, I'm sure you do, the sentiment in America against Cuba, we, of course, severed diplomatic relations some time ago. I would say Castro is about as unpopular as anybody in the world in this country. As a practical matter, what do you hope to gain through your work? How do you hope to bring about what you call fair play for Cuba, knowing the sentiment?
The principles of the fair play for Cuba consist of restoration of diplomatic trade and tourist relations with Cuba. That is one of our main points. We are for that. I disagree that this situation regarding American-Cuban relations is very unpopular. We are in a minority, surely. We are, however, not particularly interested in what Cuban exiles or rightist organizations have to say. We are primarily interested in the attitude of the United States government toward Cuba. And in that way, we are striving to get the United States to adopt measures which would be more friendly toward the Cuban people and the new Cuban regime in that country. We are not at all communist-controlled, regardless of the fact that I have the experience of living in Russia, regardless of the fact that we have been investigated, regardless of any of those facts. The Fair Play for Cuba Committee is an independent organization, not affiliated with any other organization. Our aims and our ideals are very clear and in the best keeping with American traditions of democracy.
Do you agree with Fidel Castro when he, in his last speech of July 26th of this year, he qualified President John Fitzgerald Kennedy of the United States as a ruffian and a thief? Do you agree with Mr. Castro?
I would not agree with that particular wording. However, I and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee does think that the United States government, through certain agencies, namely the State Department and the CIA, has made monumental mistakes in its relations with Cuba, mistakes which are pushing Cuba into the sphere of activity of, let's say, a very dogmatic communist country as China is.
Mr. Oswald, would you agree that when Castro first took power, would you agree that the United States was very friendly with Castro, that the people of this country had nothing but admiration for him, that they were very glad to see Batista thrown out?
I would say that the activities of the United States government in regard to Batista were a manifestation of not so much support for Fidel Castro, but rather a withdrawal of support from Batista. In other words, we stopped armaments to Batista. What we should have done was to take those armaments and drop them into the Sierra Maestra, where Fidel Castro could have used them. As for public sentiment at that time, I think even at that time, even before the revolution, there were rumblings of official comment and so forth from government officials against Fidel Castro.
You've never been to Cuba, of course, but why are the people in Cuba starving today?
Well, in any country emerging from a semi-colonial state and embarking upon reforms which require a diversification of agriculture, you're going to have shortages. After all, 80% of imports into the United States from Cuba were two products, tobacco and sugar. Nowadays, while Cuba is reducing its product as far as sugarcane goes, it is striving to grow unlimited and unheard of for Cuba quantities of certain vegetables, sweet potatoes, lima beans, cotton, and so forth, so that they can become agriculturally independent.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to interrupt. Our time is almost up. We've had three guests tonight on Conversation Carte Blanche. Bill Stuckey and I have been talking with Lee Harvey Oswald, Secretary of the New Orleans Chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, Ed Butler, Executive Director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Brignier, a Cuban refugee.
Very interesting stuff. The only man still living from that debate, that tape was from August 21st, 1963, 3 months almost to the day of the assassination, before the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. The only man still living from that debate, as I say, Carlos Brignier. Carlos, when you hear that, what do you think?
Well, I think that that showed that Castro was the real culprit in the assassination of President Kennedy. Let me tell you this. I am a survivor. I survived by God and by chance the Bay of Pigs defeat. I enrolled to go to the Bay of Pigs when I came to the United States in 1961. But when I was not in the training camp, I never went to the training camp. When I was in the motel waiting to be transferred to the training camp, I sent a letter to my wife in Argentina saying to her goodbye and explaining my motive to join the invasion. A few days after that, I received a letter from Argentina. I thought that was from my wife, but was from my father-in-law that was an Argentinian diplomat. My father-in-law was saying everything in the book to me, how I have married his daughter and have 4 children with her, and now embark in something that was going to be a disaster. When I read that letter, I took my luggage, I went to the Greyhound bus, and I took the bus to New Orleans, where one of my grandmother has born, and where my sister and her husband were at that time. I believe that the situation in that moment was terrible. When I joined to try to go to the Bay of Pigs, my brother was one of the parachutists in the Bay of Pigs. He was one of the last ones to be apprehended. And he had to survive eating lizards and drinking his own urine. And the ones that I was talking in Miami before joining the brigade was a cousin of mine that whose name was Jose Alberto Crespo Grasso, who was a pilot in the invasion, and he had come to Miami to meet his son that was just born. And I was having dinner with him and his wife, and he was telling me how they were going to win the invasion. He said that the air will be ours, and that in the way that he portrayed to me, he was like a piece of cake, okay? Now, my cousin communicated with my brother, and my brother started making arrangement over there in Guatemala for me to join my cousin in his airplane, because the airplane was going to be the safest thing in Bay of Pigs. I luckily, God guided me to receive that letter from my father-in-law, and I walked out over there and went to New Orleans. During the invasion, my cousin's plane was hit and he was killed. If I would have gone in that airplane with him, I would not be talking to you over the phone at this moment. But I was, God protected me, and I was able to live all those years.
Want to go
back? And it is, you see, when you think about the assassination, I believe that the day that Kennedy sealed his faith was in December 29, 1962. At that day, he went to the Orange Bowl to meet the Brigade 2506 that had been released by Castro after he received millions of dollars from the American government. And I was there at the stadium because my brother was there too, and a lot of my friends were there too, coming back from jail in Cuba. And I saw when Kennedy promised to return the flag of the Bay of Pigs to a free Havana very shortly. I believe that at that moment, he sealed his faith, because he, Castro knew that he had to act against Kennedy, because Kennedy had the obligation to get rid of.
When you found out, we were at the point earlier on where you find out Lee Harvey Oswald is the man who shot John Kennedy. You know that he has done it. You've been on radio with him just 3 months earlier. Did it surprise you that he had done this?
Sure. It surprised me in a way that he has been apprehended. Let me tell you this. Oswald, in my opinion, the way in that thing was planned, Oswald was going to leave Dallas, and there was a Cuban waiting for him in the Red Bear Airport in Dallas by the name of Fabian Escalante, chief of intelligence of Cuba. And Fabian Escalante had arrived in the morning of November 22nd from Mexico to the Red Bear Airport and was sitting in the airplane waiting for Oswald. When Oswald left his apartment, I believe that he was going in the direction of the Red Bear Airport, and he had left his money with his wife, and then he was confronted by the officer J.D. Tippit. I believe that J.D. Tippit was the one who destroyed the problem, because when he stopped Oswald and Oswald killed him, Oswald lost control of his thoughts, and he tried then to hide, and he went to the Texas Theater and tried to hide, but a manager of a shoe store close by saw him, saw his reaction, saw how nervous he was, and followed him to the theater, and he was the one who told the ticket taken at the front, the ticket teller at the front, to call the police. And that was when Oswald was apprehended. After Oswald was apprehended, the plane from Red Bear Airport returned to Cuba. Returned to Mexico, excuse me. And from there, Fabian Escalante went to Cuba. The plan that they had was tell Oswald that he was going to Cuba. Oswald thought that he was going to be received as a hero in Cuba. And I am sure, knowing Castro, that when the plane was going to go over the Gulf of Mexico, going to Cuba, Oswald was going to be thrown away and disposed of, and nobody would have heard any more about Lee Harvey Oswald.
Castro had promised that he was going to retaliate against Kennedy. And he said that in a speech a few months before the assassination. And he said that they were going to take the proper actions to respond to Kennedy's threat to him.
Carlos, what
And the person that Castro used in that Machiavellian activities against Kennedy was a person by the name of Rolando Cubella. That was one of the person in his army. And Rolando Cubella got in touch with the CIA and offered to have a revolt in Cuba and depose Castro. The day of November 22, 1963, Rolando Cubella was in Paris with some CIA agents, and he was asking for a rifle with telescopic sight to kill Castro. At that time was when they received the call from the United States saying that Kennedy has been killed.
Carlos, I got to ask you this. Who is Jack Ruby in all this? Why did he kill Lee Harvey Oswald?
Okay, let me tell you this. Jack Ruby, this is very interesting. I one time I sent a telegram to Jack Ruby in jail asking him to have me permission to interview him in jail. He never answered, okay? Jack Ruby was a gangster. He was associated very much with one of the gangsters. I'm trying to remember his name. It will come to my head. I am 82. Remember that. Okay. Then he went to Cuba in 1959 after Castro was in power. Okay. The name of the gangster that he was a very close friend of him was Santo Traficante. Santo Traficante was in jail in Cuba. And Santo Traficante was visited by Jack Ruby in jail in Cuba. Then, after Santo Traficante make a deal with Fidel Castro, he was the only gangster in Cuba that was allowed to leave Cuba with his money and came back to the United States acting as a double agent for Castro. He was a gangster, but he was a double agent for Castro. When Kennedy tried to contact the mafia to get rid of Castro, who learned about that? Santo Traficante. Who stopped the mafia from being able to do that? Santo Traficante. Then, Santo Traficante, I repeat to you, was a very good friend of Jack Ruby. And Jack Ruby, I never have any doubt in my mind, that was the person that was sent to silence Oswald. I was at the Secret Service office in New Orleans the day that Oswald was killed. I believe that was November 24, 1963. And I believe that was a Sunday. And I was there talking with one of the agents of the Secret Service. And when he got the telephone call, and when he answered the call, he ran, hanged up the phone and told me, Kennedy has been shot. Mm. At that moment, I thought, how convenient. Oswald is in jail that can put Castro behind the assassination of Kennedy. And now Oswald is shot. That is typical mafia. That is typical gangsterism. And Castro was a gangster. And that I for a few minutes I was in shock, almost unable to talk, because I thought that that was the end of it. Okay, but let me tell you this: the Oswald was not the only one that was going to try to kill Kennedy. I have memos from the CIA that were released in 1998, where it showed the CIA informing that they have been assassins sent by Castro to the United States to kill Kennedy. and those were never seen by the Warren Commission. The CIA kept those memos in hiding until 1998, okay? And that, to me, that is covered up completely from the beginning. And Castro was lucky that he has so many agents inside the United States.
Carlos, we only have 6 minutes left here, so I want to go. You testified before the Warren Commission. You gave them information. Their findings were Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman. Were you surprised when you heard the Warren Commission findings, and why did they find that way?
Well, I believe that the Warren Commission was formed to liquidate this assassination thing and to show that Oswald was the killer, but that there was no other government involved or any other group involved in the assassination, okay? I had the opportunity while in New Orleans also to confront Jim Garrison during his investigation of the assassination. And one day I had a confrontation with him where I told him everything in the book, okay? And he respected me. He, even in the book that he wrote, he mentioned me highly, but I believe that he was also a tool of communism in this affair about President Kennedy's assassination. I believe that the one that wanted to solve the problem and get rid of Castro again was Robert Kennedy, and unfortunately, he was killed by another person that was associated with Fidel Castro.
Carlos, what is something that you have never told anybody? You seem to know a lot of things. What is something you've never said in regard to the assassination of JFK? Is there anything you've ever...
I have talked so much about that. Even at one time in 1964, I went to 44 cities on the United States telling about the assassination of President Kennedy. And let me tell you this, something that came to my mind. In that time, I went to Dallas. And in Dallas, I was invited to visit General Walker. And General Walker showed me in the wall the impact of the bullet that Oswald had fired to him on April 10 of 1963. At that time that I met Oswald, I didn't knew nothing about his attempt against General Walker. And General Walker showed me how he was preparing his income tax return, and a piece of paper fell to the floor. And when he went down to pick up the piece of paper, bang, was when the shot came and missed him.
So, Carlos, the way it goes is Lee Harvey Oswald did pull the trigger to kill JFK, but he was put up to it by Fidel Castro.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any...
My last book that I wrote 3 years ago, the name is Crime Without Punishment, How Castro Assassinated President Kennedy and Got Away With It. And I believe that of the three books that I have written, I believe that that is the best book. And it's the most complete book about the assassination.
When it comes down to time, why would Jack Ruby risk his life? I mean, he spent the rest of his life in prison and never said anything. Why did he do that for Fidel Castro?
Well, he didn't do that for Fidel Castro. He did that for Santo Traficante, and he did that for the people of the mafia that knew him. The mafia at that time, there were some people inside the mafia that maybe were thinking that they could go back to Cuba and reopen the casinos and like Las Vegas and okay, but Jack Ruby, in my opinion, he was not a communist, he was a gangster. And the one who influenced him was Santo Traficante.
Carlos, you were with Lee Harvey Oswald 91 days before he killed President John Kennedy. Do you have any regrets in your life?
In my life, the only regret that I have, maybe, is that I didn't kill Castro in Cuba. But I was married, I have children, and I didn't want to do that because I believe that I was going to destroy my family.
What do you make of President Obama opening some relations with Cuba?
Well, I was expecting that since 2008 when Obama took over, because I always considered Obama a pro-communist guy. At that time, I was, for some reason, I sent a lot of emails, and for some reason, I was reached by the Obama organization for me to try to join them, because they were going to make a civilian military group, and they wanted to compare that group to the military, because the military, they could not take over the United States with that military, and they wanted to create a civilian military group following Obama. Later on after that, apparently they realized who I was, and they stopped sending me those emails. But I still had the copy of that email where they were referring to the civilian military group that they want to form to take over the United States.
What do you make of President Trump? He says he might stop that relationship with Cuba.
Well, I hope the best for President Trump. I believe that he is well inclined to save the United States. In the beginning, when they were, I believe that there were about 11 people running for president of the United States for the Republican Party, Trump was not my first candidate. After he was selected as the candidate for president, then I went all out for him. I voted for him. All my family voted for him. And I still believe that the best thing that happened to the United States, and maybe was God's intervention, was to Trump to arrive to the White House. We have several presidents like Jimmy Carter, like Bill Clinton, and like Barack Obama, that has been a disaster for the United States. The United States is not today what it was when I arrived to this country in 1961.
It's very an interesting life. The only man left from the radio debate from August of 1963, Carlos Bringer, with Lee Harvey Oswald. Carlos, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Scott, and I wish all the people in Ohio to have a free life, okay? And remember that freedom is very important in our life. Without freedom, I'd rather be dead.
Okay? Thank you, Carlos.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
And for this day, what an interesting story. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
I said it's about time. And I thought that was a perfectly spontaneous reaction.